Farewell, Hugh, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Trumpeter and jazz legend Hugh Masekela died today. He leaves behind a rich and funky musical legacy, but in his native South Africa, it's his work as an anti-apartheid activist that will always be remembered.
He gave us hope when we were in the yoke of colonialism and apartheid.
In fact, it was that activism that once prompted Harry Belafonte to advise Masekela to stay in the U.S.
Belafonte said to me, Hugh, why don't you stay here and try to make a name for yourself? And if you go to South Africa, you're going to go straight to jail and you're just going to be another statistic.
Our tribute to the late Hugh Masekela today on the show, plus the problem with too many solar panels imported from China and how a new tariff promises to fix that on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If you've listened to the show for a while, you may know this music. A sweet rhythm, but I can assure you, if we hear that in the studio, it makes us nervous. This track by Hugh Masekela is our emergency music. When we've got technical problems, we turn it over to him until we can figure out what's wrong. Today, though, the only problem we have is finding out that Hugh Masekela died today in Johannesburg. So today we play this tune, Uptownship, for him. We'll be hearing much more of Hugh Masekela's music today and his story, both as a musician and an activist, which is where we start the show. Masekela's big hit, of course, Grazin' in the Grass. He recorded it in 1968. The story goes that as he was completing an album, the producer told Masekela that there was still space for one more song. So he wheeled out a riff he knew from South Africa.
It's a very simple song. You know, the bass player goes dum 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 dum, and the piano player goes da 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 da, and the guitar player goes da 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 da, and the drummer goes boom boom champ boom boom champ, and we're da 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 da. So Bruce Langhorne, he held the cowbell, and I played it with two sticks. Da 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 da. We learned it in a few minutes, and we did one take, and then Russ Regan was from MCA, came later on, said, well, we've done the extra song now, and he said, this is a smash.
Remember, though, where Hugh Masekela was at the time, in exile in the United States after the violent apartheid regime in his native South Africa made living there intolerable. My BBC colleague Milton Nkosi remembers growing up in Johannesburg, listening out for Hugh Masekela.
Oh yes, I was very young and he was in exile, away from the brutal system of apartheid at the time. And his music was played not so much on the radio because he was in exile. And remember, apartheid South Africa at the time viewed all those people who were anti-apartheid activists as terrorists, if you like. So his music would be heard by those who had the LPs, the vinyl records. And that's the first time I heard of his music. Beautiful trumpeter, reminded me of great trumpeters in the jazz field in America.
So what was his significance in the anti-apartheid struggle, especially given that he was outside the country so long? I mean, how was he able to influence the course of events in South Africa musically from so far away?
What Hugh Masekela did is that he internationalized the anti-apartheid struggle through his music, through his own words, because he was just as good a talker as he was a musician. And remember that Hugh Masekela was an incredibly bright man, very straightforward thinker, and he did not mince his words. And that carried the words and the wishes, the hopes and the dreams of people who were oppressed in South Africa beyond the borders of this country. So the struggle against apartheid became internationalized by people like Hugh Masekela, who were out in the United States, in Europe, talking about the plight that black people were facing under white minority rule here.
So you say he was talking about it. I mean, exactly how did he internationalize the anti-apartheid struggle? Because I think a lot of Americans, anyway, will think Hugh Masekela and think immediately Grazing in the Grass. And maybe some other songs that, when you listen to them, don't necessarily kind of preach out against apartheid.
Okay, there are many, but one of the most prominent songs that he produced and performed was a song called Bring Back Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was in prison. He spent, of course, as we now know, 27 years in prison fighting white minority rule. Hugh Masekela sang that song, Bring Back Nelson Mandela. I want to see him walking down the streets of South Africa with Winnie Mandela. I don't think I can do justice to the talent of Hugh Masekela, but in my head, I can hear the words, I can hear the rhythm, the harmony, and that song used to boom throughout festivals around the world where people had gathered to show their solidarity with South Africa. And also, he worked on the cultural boycott. Remember that apartheid South Africa had sanctions from the United Nations because apartheid was declared a crime against humanity at the United Nations. So people like Hugh Masekela made it a point that the cultural boycott was enforced so that artists who are international could not come and perform in apartheid South Africa until the regime had an inclusive approach to politics where black people could participate in the political processes of their own country.
What is the mood today in Johannesburg, Milton?
People are shocked and saddened. I am surprised, Marco, how saddened I was. I thought that I would be not as sad as I became, because Hugh Masekela was a much loved figure in South Africa. He gave us hope when we were in the yoke of colonialism and apartheid. So South Africans are saddened. They are calling radio stations. They are calling TV news channels here. There's only one story in town in South Africa. People are paying tribute. They are remembering Hugh Masekela. They are remembering the beautiful sound of his trumpet. Remember, there's nobody else who could play it better than him, except for those greats that he played with. He played with Herb Alpert. He played with Louis Armstrong. Remember, he performed with Jimi Hendrix. He's been around over all those decades, playing across the genres and across the color line.
Milton, is there one personal memory meeting Hugh Masekela that you'll always kind of just hang on to?
Yes. One memorable story he once told me was that when he was in the United States, he had spoken English for such a long time that his tongue had become heavy in his mouth. He wished and he wanted to speak the local South African languages, but there was no one to talk to. And he walked to Central Park in New York and he started speaking a street language here in South Africa known as Tsotsitaal. And he said people thought he was mad because he was talking to himself. But at that time, he was producing and creating songs simultaneously as being nostalgic for his own home language.
Wow. Some powerful memories there. That was the BBC's Milton Nkosi in Johannesburg. I had the privilege of interviewing Hugh Masekela twice. Just last year, we spoke about his involvement in the Rumble in the Jungle concert in 1974, the big show that coincided with the famous Ali Foreman fight in what was then Zaire. But it's the interview I did with Masekela in 1999 that I really remember. He came into our studios here in Boston and talked for nearly an hour about his inspirations as a trumpeter, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis. But the real reason he first picked up the horn? Hollywood.
No, I saw a movie in 1953 called Young Men with a Horn. I don't know if you've seen it in the Late Late Show. The story of Big Spider Big. It starred Kirk Douglas. Harry James, who had the most beautiful tone, did the soundtrack for that. And they had beautiful songs like I'm in the Mood for Love, My Dream is Yours, Stardust, you name it. But the drama of the movie got me, because in the movie he stood always in front of the band. He didn't take any rubbish from anybody, especially not the band leader. Always got the girl. and got to play all the solos. And I said, damn, that's the instrument. I didn't know that you had to practice so hard and that it was such a difficult instrument.
Yeah, not as if the trumpet was an easy instrument. Hugh Masekela did make it sound easy, though. In that 1999 interview, I also asked him about his political activism. Masekela lived in exile from South Africa for 3 decades, mostly in the U.S. He told me that at one point he almost went home, but it was Harry Belafonte who talked him out of it.
Belafonte said to me, Hugh, why don't you stay here and try to make a name for yourself? Because you're a very, very activist-minded person. If you go to South Africa, you're going to go straight to jail, and you're just going to be another statistic because nobody will know you. But if you stay here and make a name for yourself, said, you're going back at home to a home. You're going back home at a time when people like Mandela have been sentenced to death, and all your colleagues and all the people you grew up with are either being killed or they're running away from South Africa. It's a weird time to go home. But if you make a name, and I said, Harry, how do I know that I'm going to make a name for myself? And he said, well, I can't guarantee you that, but we're here to be on your side and stand by you.
So Hugh Masekela stayed for some time, but he never forgot where he came from.
My grandmother, when she raised us, she always said to us, remember that when you were born, you came here naked. You didn't have a penny. You had nowhere to stay. You didn't have any clothes. And it took us 3 years to teach you just where the bathroom was. And you will always owe us because you lived here rent-free with food and clothing for 17 to 18 years. And you'll never be able to repay us. And we come from a nation that feels the same way. And everything that you got, you weaned from them. And your duty is to always remember when you get praised that you yourself have nothing without your people. And if you came from Germany, you'd probably be skiers or brewers. You know, if you came from Russia, you'd probably be vodka distillers. But you're just the product of the people you come from, and you will always owe them.
And he had these parting thoughts at the end of that interview, something his father taught him long ago.
The most important thing that he taught us was that it is also very important not to grow up and to act foolish when you can.
A few excerpts from one of my interviews with the late Hugh Masekela. Earlier today, I asked Hugh Masekela's former bass player, Bakiti Kumalo, to choose 3 songs that he feels are crucial to Masekela's body of work. First up, he selected Bring Him Back Home, Nelson Mandela.
Bring back Nelson Mandela, bring him back home to Soweto.
When he wrote the song, we were all there. For him, it was all about bringing Nelson Mandela back home, and we want to see him and walking on the streets of South Africa with Winnie Mandela. And the song was so strong and so powerful. I mean, I cried every time I played the song.
I want to see him walking hand in hand with Winnie Mandela.
More music from Hugh Masekela later in the show. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. So I'll be honest, lately when I see a hashtag, I get nervous. activism itself doesn't make me nervous, but the idea of so many hashtags implies to me there are so many different causes. So what can possibly be the impact of so many hashtags? Well, the Me Too movement is one of the most visible hashtags of the past year, but the campaign, minus the hashtag, it actually started more than 10 years ago by civil rights activist Tarana Burke to give a voice to sexual abuse victims. Then once the allegations against Harvey Weinstein became known last year, the hashtag got added and it quickly exploded. Sophie Chow is our data journalist here at The World, and she's been analyzing how the media have covered the Me Too movement. So what have you found?
So I've been using a tool called Media Cloud, which lets you look at how the news covers something. So it lets you search keywords in a giant database of news articles. And I found some interesting patterns, basically that Hollywood celebrities and the accused people, who are often, you know, white males of power, have really been the focus of the conversation. If you remember, during the Golden Globes, 8 actresses took activists as dates.
Right.
And I was looking up that in the U.S. mainstream media, and I found that the actresses' names appeared in news stories about Me Too far more frequently than the activists' names.
Hmm. So does that suggest that this is about celebrity and less about the cause?
Well, I was talking to Bernice Young, who is a reporter for Reveal, and she covers issues of harassment and assault among low-wage workers. I asked her about how the media tended to focus on celebrities, and she's not really surprised about that.
You know, as members of the press, we do tend to gravitate toward people who are brand names, or they lend a level of credibility. What struck me and my colleagues was that a lot of the workers that we had looked at, where they had faced very extreme sexual harassment, and I'm talking, you know, sexual assault and rape, they weren't as present in that conversation initially. I think there's been some shift, you know, but I think they're just voices that I personally think we need to hear more from. It happens to women in all ends of the economic spectrum.
So, Sophie, I guess we shouldn't be surprised either, but I'm curious, too, how some pushback also from celebrities either worked against or for the Me Too movement. Because a couple of weeks back, you may recall, French actress Catherine Deneuve signed an open letter with 99 other French women basically saying we're against the Me Too movement and how they see it as a puritanical invasion of American morals in France. Did that pushback letter grab as much attention or more attention than Me Too? And what did it do to the Me Too space on social media?
Well, it didn't get more attention than Me Too in general. But in the case of Catherine Deneuve in the U.S., actually, we covered her more frequently than the French media did.
Interesting. So when we look at this globally, hashtags often take simple phrases, well, in any language, think Me Too, for example, but you could also think about Je suis Charlie, and it makes it understandable for many people who may not speak that language. How has that kind of aided in the spread of hashtags around the world?
Yeah, all around the world, the English version is definitely the most popular, and people have tweeted in different languages, but there's really been all different kinds of translated versions, like the French one, Balance ton porc, which is like call out your pig.
Right.
And that's been the most popular translated one. There's about 600,000 tweets with that tag. But there's also been translated in Italian, in Spanish, in Arabic. They've all gotten significant traction, although less than the English one.
Sophie Chow, the world's data journalist. Thanks for crunching the numbers.
Thank you, Marco.
You can see the charts and numbers behind Sophie's story about the media and the Me Too movement. Check them out at PRI.org. We focused a lot on the world on the migrant crisis in Europe over the past 2 years. From across the Middle East and North Africa, tens of thousands of people are risking everything to leave war and poverty behind. Tonight's episode of Frontline follows just a few of them making the journey. And there's one scene that really caught my attention. African migrants gathered in a forest just outside Ceuta and Melilla. Those are the Spanish enclaves along the northern coast of Morocco. Suddenly, they take off, scrambling over rocks in an attempt to get over the fence that divides Africa and Europe. The fence is 20 feet tall and topped with razor wire.
The best way to be successful in climbing this fence is just to do it in numbers. Just collect everyone and run at it at the same time and overwhelm the border security forces.
James Blumel is the director of Exodus. The journey continues.
These sort of quasi-military groups spring up and they organize and they train And so when the time is right and they're going to hit the fence, they'll do it just before dawn, and it'll be 500 of them all running. Mm. And maybe if they're lucky, 3 or 4 might get through.
Many of them were very lucky, but not the man you focus on, Musa. Tell us what happened to him.
He didn't make it. Musa will try again. He's committed. He's come this far. He can see Spain from his forest camp. Mm. There's no way he's going to give up.
Is it the vast majority of refugees who are kind of stuck in their efforts to migrate, or the exceptions right now?
It's the vast majority. The borders across Europe have shut. The rise of far-right nationalism has increased, therefore sort of putting pressure onto moderate governments. And the closing of the borders and refusing to take any more refugees and deporting refugees that they do have has become the norm.
So for me, I got to say the most captivating character in Exodus is Isra. She's a 13-year-old girl from Syria who has resettled with her family in Germany. There's this great scene of Isra's mother pinning a hijab on her, and she puts on a studded leather jacket with it. She feels really cool. Let's just hear this.
Rihta shampoo. Jimmy?
So she's smiling there and shouting that her hair smells of shampoo, the smell of freedom, she says. I mean, I got to say, as an American, it is so profound to hear that, because otherwise I would hear that as a shampoo commercial tagline. But for Isra to say it, it is the smell of freedom. And she's fitting in. She says they've got democracy here in Germany. Everybody's got a boyfriend. And she's really liberated for a 13-year-old. But what do her parents make of how she's adapted so well to Germany?
What Germany can offer her in the future is exactly what she's looking for. For her parents, they're clever people. They are sensitive and understanding. They will struggle with her freedoms. And her father was the breadwinner of that family in Syria. He was the alpha male. He's now in Germany, and he is the burden. Israha is the one that speaks German. Israha will be the one that gets a job. Israha will be the one that rescues that family. He's got to come to terms with that, and that's going to be complicated too.
How does he feel about that? Is he okay with that?
He's resigned to that. I think he's done this journey not for himself. He's rescued his family. He brought his family to a place of safety. They were from Aleppo. He did the right thing. He got them out. Germany is not probably going to be the country that he does particularly well in, but for his children, they can.
James, you spoke about the rise of the right wing in parts of Europe and how that's pressuring moderate governments to kind of look at the refugees and new arrivals differently. Did you see a connection to the lives of Isra, and how is she going to deal with the rise of the right wing as she gets older?
Whenever you go to one of these anti-refugee marches, the number of people that are demonstrating who are against refugees are tiny compared to the pro-refugee protesters there as well. It is problematic. It is worrying. It is dangerous. The numbers are still small. She can navigate that, I hope.
James Blumel is the director of Exodus, The Journey Continues, on Frontline. You can catch it on PBS stations tonight at a special time. That's 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central. I'm Marco Werman. 20 years ago, flood struck a village in Peru, and the impact on the health of young survivors was huge.
What we found is that children who were living in communities the most affected by flooding had the worst loss in height.
Could new floods this year have the same effect? Find out, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It'd be too easy to just say Donald Trump is not interested in renewable energy. But this new tariff he's imposed on imported solar panels, it actually came at the request of two American solar manufacturing companies who say they can't compete with cheap imports coming mostly from China. The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler is here with more. So how much is this tariff, Carolyn, and why does the government say it's necessary?
It starts at 30% in the first year and then decreases down to a 15% tariff after 4 years. The U.S. International Trade Commission recommended this tariff after finding that a flood of state-subsidized solar panels coming in mostly from China has nearly destroyed the U.S. manufacturing industry when it comes to solar panels, and that trade protections are necessary to safeguard what's left of that industry.
So how much have cheap imports from China actually impacted the solar industry here in the States?
The impact has really been two-sided. So on the one hand, cheap Chinese solar panels supercharged the U.S. solar industry. It really depressed prices for solar panels, which increased their uptake. So between 2012 and 2016, solar electricity generation in the U.S. tripled. And wow. With that came jobs. There are about 260,000 people employed in this sector today. But then on the other side of the equation is the manufacturing side. And the import of these panels, which are subsidized by tax credits in China, have nearly destroyed the U.S. manufacturing industry. Around 24 U.S. manufacturers of solar panels have closed in the past 6 years or so. And the two companies that requested this intervention, one of them actually declared bankruptcy last spring.
All right. So those two companies, I would guess, are happy with this tariff. Who's unhappy?
Basically, everyone else, including much of the solar energy industry itself. So the Solar Energy Industries Association estimates that this tariff will cost about 23,000 American jobs in the first year, including in solar installation and manufacturing of associated components like the racks that attach solar panels to roofs. Environmentalists worry that this is going to slow down the uptake of solar, which is a renewable energy source. One estimate from an energy analyst guesses that the move will reduce new U.S. solar installations by about 10 to 15% in the next 5 years. And of course, China. China is not happy about this.
Yeah, so I mean, this has trade war written all over it. Has China indicated how they're going to retaliate?
They have not mentioned any specifics. A Chinese government spokesperson has said that along with other World Trade Organization members, it will, quote, resolutely defend its legitimate trade interests, but it hasn't said how. So we sort of have to wait and see whether this move and then the new washing machine tariff that was announced at the same time does lead to increased trade tensions between the U.S. and Asia.
The World's Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
So let's dial back for a moment to that concern Carolyn mentioned from environmentalists. They're afraid the new tariff on imported solar panels will slow the transition here in the U.S. from dirty fossil fuels to cleaner renewable energy. We don't know for sure that'll happen, but we do know that if you're concerned about the disruption of our climate, that transition can't move fast enough. That's because climate change and increasingly extreme weather are already harming people around the world, and there's evidence that kids can be especially vulnerable. This week, our Livable Planet desk is taking a special look at kids and climate change. We're going to hear how they might be affected by it and how they're learning about it, also how they're getting active in the fight against it. We start today in Peru. That's where a pair of massive floods may have set some kids up for lifelong health problems. Here's reporter Deepa Fernandez.
Flor Bautista watches her children play on the dusty ground near the city of Piura on Peru's northern coast. She's standing near the tent that's been their home after massive flooding destroyed their tiny house last March.
When the water came, we were here in our little huts. The water came quickly and flooded everything.
The rising waters took everyone in her town by surprise that early morning. They'd been suffering through a long drought. Then, all of a sudden, came torrential downpours, which led to the river breaching and a massive flood. It was a weather swing like no one there had ever experienced before.
We had to escape to the mountains, and it was there the children got sick. They lost weight and became malnourished.
There was no fresh produce for months, which Bautista feels really hurt her younger children. There were also problems with access to clean water. Three-year-old Camila got diarrhea that never let up, but there were no doctors to see. And when she was finally able to take Camila to the doctor, there was no medicine. Kids are often the hardest hit by extreme weather events, and climate change is helping make these kinds of things more common around the world. Here in this tiny village, which looks like a refugee camp, I'm surrounded by pleading mothers. Each one is begging me to come to her tent to see her sick child. There are so many sick children here, even months after the flood waters have subsided. And if new research from a similar event near here 20 years ago can give us some hints of what's to come, this might be the start of a lifetime of bad health for these little ones. More on that in a moment. For now, Maria Martinez pulls me to her tent. She's desperate.
Él es Yenko Samir.
Yenko Samir, the littlest of her seven children, was only 7 months when the flood hit. Martinez says he's been sick ever since.
He got bronchitis and fever, and there was no medical help.
Then he had diarrhea.
And there are concerns that even the kids who did get to see doctors have not been properly diagnosed and treated. Carlos Mendoza is a local community leader.
They were seen so quickly. There wasn't really any personal attention given to the sick kids. So they maybe got better, but then in 15 days or 1 month, they were sick again.
When the floods came, the six children were brought here. It's the pediatric emergency room of one of Piura's main hospitals. Germs spread quickly in a flood, and babies and toddlers are especially vulnerable. Months later, hospital director Dr. Jose Fernandez Andrade says that small children are still coming in at higher than normal rates.
For children under 5, we have seen an increase in respiratory illness, diarrhea, and even dengue.
That's partly because many are still living in substandard conditions.
Unfortunately, in these conditions, many safety precautions couldn't be followed, like only using safe water.
This all worries Dr. William Checkley. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University in the US who led that study I mentioned of a similar event near here 20 years ago. The city of Tumbes experienced torrential rains and flooding during an especially strong El Niño weather cycle, and babies and toddlers got very sick.
We also found that the children who were born during and shortly after the 97-98 El Niño episode were on average shorter in height and had less lean mass for their age and sex.
Checkley's research documented that hospital visits for small children shot up. There were higher incidents of diarrhea, and the devastation of homes, roads, crops, and livestock affected nutrition for years to come. Dr. Checkley says the impact on babies and toddlers was harsh.
So what we found is that the children who were living in communities the most affected by flooding had the worst loss in height.
The study showed stunted growth was widespread in affected areas. That was almost two decades ago. I wanted to find some of the now young adults who were affected back then. So I came to this little village called San Francisco. It's sunny and relaxed here. Kids mill about, along with vendors touting their goods. I'm meeting one of the babies from Dr. Checkley's study on the effects of the horrid storms of 1997-98. Her name is Kathy. She's now 19. Back then, she was sick with diarrhea, and researchers have come to check in on her over the years since. Today, Kathy works part-time in a local preschool. Her path has definitely been different to that of her friends, who were not sick like she was.
No tengo secundaria completa.
She's telling me she dropped out of high school. She didn't like studying. All her friends graduated, but she just couldn't stick it through, she says. And she had a baby when she was a teen. Of course, one can't draw a straight line between childhood illness and dropping out of high school, but Kathy's life might well have turned out differently. Dr. Checkley of Johns Hopkins says there's a long list of health impacts from stunting.
So stunting can lead to increased risk of infection, such as pneumonia. It leads to reduced neurodevelopmental and cognitive function, loss of physical growth potential, and just physical performance and economic productivity. And there are also studies that link stunting to a higher risk of chronic disease in adulthood.
The floods in Tumbes 20 years ago were because of that ferocious El Niño. That's a weather event that brings big rainfalls to this part of the world every few years. But what happened in Piura this year was beyond anything people here had seen before. After a long drought, the weather suddenly flipped to months of torrential downpours. The local government was caught unprepared, and officials are convinced that climate change contributed to the extreme weather.
De una situación de sequía grave.
To go from a state of emergency declaration for the extreme drought to a state of emergency declaration due to flooding has never happened to us before in Piura.
Here's Piura's chief administrator of environmental issues, Ronald Ruiz Chapiaquen.
We think it's a global climate phenomenon behind these sudden climate swings.
Climate scientists generally agree, and they see this kind of thing happening more and more around the world. Here, when the flooding began earlier this year, authorities scrambled to get help to people. Now that the waters have subsided, the priority is moving families out of tents and into better housing. But even this process doesn't seem to have reached many in small outer villages. And the mothers I'm meeting wonder if anyone is paying attention to the health of their small children. In the tent city where many flood victims are living, conditions are still harsh. Gloria Vega opens her tent and points to a mattress on the floor where her daughter and three small children sleep. Vega says she just took the small one to the doctor with a bad cough. It's super dusty here. Just walking around, I'm covered in a thick white coat of the stuff. Vega tells the kids to come out of the tent. She wants to zip it closed to keep the dust out. But there's not much here for the kids to do except play in the dust and breathe it in. It's a long road ahead to get their lives back on track, and likely a long road ahead for vulnerable kids elsewhere, as the kind of extreme weather that landed this family here becomes more common. For the world, Thipa Fernandez, Piura, Peru.
Tomorrow, Thipa takes us to the mountains of Guatemala. Changes in the weather there mean kids can't get a lot of their traditional healthy foods anymore.
There are no markets in Diaz's town, San Luis. The family's daily meals come straight from a small garden. It's called a milpa. It's very green, but it's also kind of in shambles. Diaz's little plots have been destroyed by a massive hailstorm, she tells me. And it wasn't the only weird weather recently. The past few months it's begun raining heavily at 10 a.m., she says. The soil is too soft.
Como que no es normal.
It's not normal.
Porque si no lo doy de alimentación, de
and this worries her deeply because she hasn't been able to properly feed her children.
Estoy bien preocupada en cómo para...
It's a story I hear all over this part of Guatemala.
We've got the rest of that story tomorrow. And check out the whole series on kids and climate change online. It's at PRI.org. Here's another song by the late Hugh Masekela, who died today at the age of 78. We've been listening to some of his crucial tracks throughout the show today. Masekela's former bass player, Bakiti Kumalo, helped us out with the song selection. Earlier we heard Bring Him Back Home, Nelson Mandela. Here's a song called Kauleza.
The song called Kauleza in English is hurry, 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 you know, you have to hurry up. So the song was about really having a good time and drinking and thinking that the cops are coming, you might get in trouble. Because at the same time, with the struggle, you have to enjoy yourself. But the song was about enjoy yourself, but always remember that you might end up in jail. The Hugh Masekela song Kauleza, chosen as a favorite by his former bass player, Bakiti Kumalo. We'll have more of my conversation with Kumalo coming up in just a few, and hey, we are not going to miss a chance to hear more music from Masekela himself. So stick around, you're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Our friends at the BBC produce a lot of great stories, and often we hear something that we just have to share with you. Like this one. It comes from a BBC radio journalist in the Midlands region of England. He plays soccer, or as the locals there insist on calling it, football, on a minor league level team.
I'll let him introduce himself.
My name's Richie Anderson, and I love football. I love playing for my Sunday league team, Coombswood FC. To the best of my knowledge, my teammates are straight and have no idea that I'm gay.
It's funny, really, because in every other part of society, I'm out and I'm proud. My friends know, my family know, but as soon as I'm here on a football pitch, it just feels like a taboo.
So why am I and other gay footballers keeping quiet? Well, last year, campaign group Kick It Out received its highest number of reports of abuse across all levels of football, 20% of them relating to homophobia. My teammates know I'm making a film about grassroots football, but have no idea what I'm about to say.
Get away from that camera,
yeah, boys, before you go, I just wanted to have a quick chat with you all. One of the big issues that we've looked at this week, which is like, it's really close to like my heart, is homophobia in football. And the reason why that means a lot to me, because I'm a gay footballer. So, you know, and I just wanted to kind of be open and honest, because with you, like, it's just been class. And like, and this is really hard for me to do now, but I just kind of felt like I just wanted to. But no, seriously, like, thank you. That means a lot.
There's going to be absolutely no difference whatsoever. Rich is Richie, it doesn't matter who you are, what colour, what race, what sexuality you are. You're a player for this team.
Yeah, you need a lot of courage to do it, so you could see he was emotional and that, so now fair play to him.
It probably doesn't mean as much to us as it does to him, so I'm really proud for him to be able to come out and, you know, say what he said, and for the lads to be as supported as they were.
So relieved, so relieved, I can't even tell you. Oh, I expected it because they're a good bunch of lads, and it probably helped that I scored as well, but I'm so relieved. But the main thing is, I hope there's people who are in the same boat that I was in, and they're thinking, you know what, I can do that as well.
Yeah, told you it was a great story. The BBC's Richie Anderson describing what it was like telling his soccer teammates that he is gay. So let's end today with one more story about South African jazz great Hugh Masekela, who has died at the age of 78. This one comes courtesy of Future Folk, a partnership between the World and Smithsonian Folkways. Throughout the show today, we've been hearing from Bakiti Kumalo, Masekela's former bass player. Kumalo was with Masekela when he returned to South Africa after nearly 30 years of exile during apartheid.
Man, it was unbelievable. I came with him because he was doing a tour in South Africa called Segunjalo. That means this is it, Segunjalo. And that tour was the first time for him to perform in Johannesburg and Cape Town and Durban and Lesotho. So I was on the plane with him that whole plane ride. We couldn't sleep talking about going home. And he said, man, I'm so excited. I was so happy for him. When he got home, his tears just rolled down his face and his father was there. Bunch of his family was there. I mean, like, it was just an unbelievable moment. And I felt so grateful that, wow, I'm the guy who brought him home.
Masekela was a pioneer of South African jazz in the 1950s with his band, the Jazz Epistles. During apartheid, two styles of jazz emerged, one created by South African musicians in exile and those still in South African townships. Bakiti Kumalo says township jazz styles developed because the government controlled what a lot of musicians were exposed to under apartheid.
The radio station was controlled by the government in South Africa. So the music that we had on the radios, it was more like American, British music. And then musicians would take those songs and play in the township style. I grew up in a house where my uncle was a saxophone player, and he used to listen to Count Basie, Duke Ellington, then play like 12 bar blues. And I'm like, what is 12 bar blues? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was the music that was sold to us, the radio station, and we would listen to like So all the wind instrument players, they started to learn about playing in the big bands. And then the jazz became township jazz. Kipi Moeketsi, another legend saxophone player, Dudu Pukwane, Jonas Gwangwa. They took the jazz because West African music was not played in radios. When Hugh Masekela was already in exile, I was doing a lot of session in South Africa. And I was playing with all the traditional local musicians like Zulu, Sotho, Shangaan, And then at night, my band and I, we go and play some Cool in the Gang, Earthwind and Fire. You know, I was mixing it up. So I was really versatile that I can play jazz and then play fusion. I was open-minded to learn and not just be stuck as a South African bass player, but play everything.
Hugh Masekela, of course, wasn't just a musician. He was an activist. So I'm wondering if there's a song you can point to that will kind of become a standard for you that really echoes Hugh Masekela.
I mean, I would say Stimela, man. Stimela was about people working in the mine, working for almost no pay to try to feed their families, but they lose their lives. And he wanted to let the world know about what was going on. And that song was powerful. That song stole my heart. That's why I really learned and understand more about South Africa when I was working with Hugh and playing these songs every night. And he said, you know, play these songs like you mean it. And every time I play these songs, I just see my township and I see the mine and I just see the struggle, you know, which is still happening. 30 years I've been gone. My people, they're still struggling. So those songs, that's for my generation. This man did so much for us. That's why we have to celebrate his legacy and just continue with his message.
Bakiti Kumalo, Hugh Masekela's bass player, our condolences. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, and rest in peace, Rahio.
Stimela by the late Hugh Masekela ends our show today. So sad to lose him, but it'll always be wonderful to hear his music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.